From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR sports program, Only a Game. It's summer vacation week here at Only a Game, and by that I mean that our staff is on summer vacation, and we're also celebrating summer vacations with this week's show.
I had just gotten my driver's license in March. Guess I had to learn how to drive pretty fast.
They said, "Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm in. I'll do it."
In general, his entire journey, I think, went almost like a dream.
Summer vacation stories of sandlot baseball, mini golf, and cross-country travel by car, by bicycle, and by mules. Just ahead on Only a Game. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The summer I was 10 or so, I went to camp in Maine. It was a warm and sunny camp, and rarely did it rain. And at the baseball tryout, I pulled out my catcher's mitt, and that was when the coach said, "Son, perhaps you'd better sit." It seems they had a catcher. They were happy with his play. So I worked on my hitting. Maybe that was how I'd stay. I hit while others went to crafts or practiced volleyball. I hit while they were swimming or were in the dining hall. And when they shot their 22s or fooled around a bit, I went back to the diamond because that was where I hit. The story has a happy ending, strange as that may seem. The coach did notice all my work and said, "You're on the team." This week on Only a Game, we're telling stories on a theme. You might call it what I did on my summer vacation if that wasn't the fallback position of every first-year teacher in every sixth-grade classroom in the country. Ah, what the heck, let's go with it anyway. When Pierce Norton returned to school in the fall of his junior year, he had quite a story to tell about America, a birthday party, and a one-of-a-kind sporting event. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
The year was 1976. "Don't Go Breaking My Heart" by Elton John and Kiki D was on the radio. The movie Rocky was a surprise hit, and
people were looking for a party.
That's Kurt Lewis. In 1976, he had just finished his journalism degree at Wichita State.
You know, Vietnam was just over in 75. You know, Watergate was over, Nixon was gone, and everyone was looking for a good time.
And there was an excuse to celebrate.
Happy birthday, Uncle
ABC News goes to the Great American Birthday Party.
The U.S. was turning 200, and that birthday party seemed to last all year. In honor of the bicentennial, trains and airplanes were painted red, white, and blue. A fleet of tall ships sailed down the Hudson River. And there was a horse race unlike any other. It was called the Great American Horse Race. And it would span nearly 100 days and 3,500 miles, starting in New York, heading to Missouri, and then
trying to follow the Pony Express route from St. Joe on.
Kurt Lewis was hired by the race organizers to document all the greatness and Americanness of the Great American Horse Race, and also the competition. The rider who covered the distance fastest would get $25,000, worth about $100,000 in today's dollars. About 100 riders signed up. Cowboys took a break from rodeos. World War II veterans, finished with their missions on submarines and B-17 bombers, also entered. So did a sheriff, and even an Austrian count.
Count Johannes Hoyas. And he was a good guy.
And then there was Verl Norton. He was one of the oldest riders. He didn't have as big a bank account as most of the others. He didn't have any fancy horse equipment or a big crew to help him set up camp or cook or do laundry. But he had a plan. See, while some riders entered Icelandic ponies, quarter horses, and Appaloosas, the consensus was the horse to ride, if you wanted to win, was an Arabian.
The sport of endurance horse riding is won by Arabian horses. The motto, if you're not riding an Arabian, you're following an Arabian.
But Verl Norton was going to challenge that motto. It was the Great American Horse Race, but Verl Norton entered a mule.
He always had a hankering for mules, I think, maybe from his childhood.
That's Verl's son, Pierce. Most of the riders had a crew of two or three to help along the race. Verl only had Pierce, and Pierce was only 16.
I had just gotten my driver's license in March. Guess I had to learn how to drive pretty fast.
Even with a mule and a crew of one teenager, Verl Norton was confident that he was going to win.
He was quite a social, charismatic guy, and we'd go into a restaurant and he'd start talking about it, and he wouldn't kind of hold back his confidence, and I would kind of be a little sheepish back there thinking, well, we need to see what's going to happen here.
So why did Verl Norton have such confidence in his mule and his 16-year-old son? Let's back up a little bit. Verl Norton was born in Wyoming in 1916. As a teenager, he caught and trained wild horses. He and his family also worked mules on their farm.
And so he had an understanding of what the strengths and weaknesses of mules were.
Verl learned that mules are slow, generally not a good quality for a race. But he also learned that mules have stamina and durability, good qualities for the 3,500-mile Great American Horse Race. Verl got married and settled in San Jose, California. He worked as a steeplejack. He went around the country painting tall things like towers and smokestacks. And he had a family.
There was five of us children and my mother, and then my dad would be out, you know, painting, and he'd be in Sacramento or North Dakota or someplace, and he'd come home every couple weeks. When I was about 8 years old, my mom got breast cancer and got pretty ill. And all of us kids, since my father wasn't there all the time, we got shipped off to some relatives in Idaho and Wyoming. We were all with different relatives.
Pierce ended up in Idaho.
I went up to my Uncle DeLosses, who had a cattle ranch and farm, and he had six kids there himself and a two-bedroom house. You know, you're getting up in the morning feeding cows and things like that. It's a completely different life. When I first went up there, I think kind of the pretense was, this is a temporary thing. We're going to go up until my mother gets better. Now, that's what I understood as an eight-year-old kid. So I was at my Uncle DeLosses' house, and he got a phone call. This was in May of 69 when my mother died, and that was the phone call. And that kind of, I mean, I think I became an adult right there. Everything became clear. I'm on my own at this point.
Pierce and his siblings stayed with relatives. Meantime, Verl sold the family's home in San Jose to pay off hospital bills. He moved into a house trailer on the family ranch outside of town. But unlike his siblings, Pierce didn't adjust well to his new setting.
I never quite fit in and became one of the family.
So when Pierce was 12, his father came to get him. Pierce moved on to the ranch with his dad.
He had another house trailer there right next door, and so I lived in my own house trailer from the time I went down there at 12 years old. So he would seriously be gone for a month or more at a time, and I would just take care of the ranch and myself and get to school and cook my meals and do my laundry and whatever else had to be done. It didn't seem strange to me. It probably seemed strange to other people.
Which is to say that by the time Verl Norton saw the ad for the Great American Horse Race in the magazine Western Horseman, 16-year-old Pierce was well-prepared to be his dad's crew. So Verl and Pierce set out from California for the starting line in New York in a 1971 Dodge pickup with loose steering, hauling a camper in a low-end horse trailer that didn't have any horses in it. What it did carry was Lord Fauntleroy, nicknamed Leroy, and a backup mule named Lady Eloise. On May 31st, 1976, the Great American Horse Race began. The race was structured like the Tour de France. There was a set course for each day, usually about 35 miles, and the riders were clocked at the start and finish. At first, Verl's strategy didn't pay off.
There was people going full blast the first day, you know, probably rode twice as fast as my dad did. Sooner or later, you start to wonder, well, you know, I wonder if this is a good strategy. Like, you know, I'm thinking, well, if these guys keep it up, there's no way to be able to make up this time.
But here's another thing you need to know about the Great American Horse Race, and maybe you've been wondering this. Veterinarians accompanied the group, and there were mandatory checks throughout the day. If a horse, or mule, showed any signs of breaking down, even if it just wasn't walking right, the horse, or mule, would have to ride in the trailer until it was healthy again. And that meant penalty time for the riders. So as the days went on, more and more horses started breaking down, and more riders started getting penalty time. And that wasn't the only thing slowing some teams.
Plenty of drinking on this thing, and, you know, people up in the middle of the night screaming and hollering and fighting and where's my girlfriend, that sort of thing.
That's Kurt Lewis again. And while other competitors were getting into trouble, Lewis says Pierce was...
absolutely positively focused. I mean, he was busy all the time. He was doing things. It was a full-time job to do everything he had to do. Do laundry, shopping, groceries, cook, and all that sort of thing.
And with a focused crew and a healthy ride, Sure enough,
they had a begrudging respect for the mule sooner or later.
Because about a quarter of the way into the race, in Kankakee, Illinois, Verl Norton and Leroy went out ahead of all the Arabians.
He'd always said that he hadn't planned on taking the lead that early. So everybody ran their horses down a little bit sooner than he thought, I guess. You know, as soon as we got into the lead, there's a long ways to go, but it was, you know, we're going in the right direction. It was like the lead was getting longer.
And so days before the finish, it became clear that a mule was going to win the Great American Horse Race. And on the last day,
there was a whole bank of press photographers there, you know, and it was just these cameras flashing and going off like crazy. Some of the other competitors put my dad up on their shoulders and ran him around the fairgrounds there a little bit. I don't know if we ever really had like a kind of a moment where we did a high five or anything. He wasn't that kind of guy. He could just look over and nod at me, and I would know that he was satisfied with the job that I did.
Winning the race got Verl Norton into newspapers and on TV. It earned him respect among his horse-loving friends for the rest of his life. For Pierce, there was no fame. When the race was over, he went back to high school. He's a scientist now, and he says he hasn't ridden a horse or a mule in 20 years. But the Great American Horse Race remains special.
You know, I'm 56 years old now, and in the 40 years since that race happened, there's not a bigger event in my life.
Verl Norton died in 1995. 2 years before he passed, Verl got to relive some of the race through a book co-authored by Kurt Lewis. And today, Pierce Norton remembers his father fondly.
I come to appreciate some stuff kind of later on. My dad raised me kind of on his own. And his best attribute, I think, is he could get more out of a person than they thought they could give. He would give you an opportunity to prove to yourself that, you know, you were good.
And in 1976, Verl and Pierce Norton and their mule Leroy proved to America that they weren't just good, they were great.
That story, by Only a Game's Martin Kessler, originally aired last September in honor of the 40th anniversary of the end of the Great American Horse Race. To read more about that event, check out Kurt Lewis's book with Dennis Underwood, The Great American Horse Race of 1976, a photographic documentary. A second edition is due out soon, and you can link to it at onlyagame.org. Ahead on Only a Game, when his high school baseball team faltered, Coach Rob Query came up with an unusual form of motivation.
Guys, I said, I've got some news. I said, I'm pregnant. And they all laughed, and, you know, they were hooting and hollering, and they were excited. And then I said, and if you guys win 14 games, you get to name the kid.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. What do you got there, Karen?
It's an Only a Game fidget spinner.
A what?
You know, those plastic things that spin around and around. Do you want one?
No. Why would I want one?
I don't know. They're apparently very popular with the younger crowd.
Really? Well, let's ask Martin.
Can't talk spinning.
See?
Maybe we should offer these gadgets to listeners. Gary, what do you think?
Sounds great, boss.
All right, here's the deal. We'll send a fidget spinner to listeners who follow us on Facebook and Twitter and leave a review of the show on iTunes.
Send us a message through Facebook to let us know when you've done it.
And keep those iTunes reviews coming. They really do help other listeners find our show.
I'm Bill Littlefield.
Strictly speaking, the cosmic tale of the White Dragon Horse begins without the White Dragon Horse.
I encountered this particular cosmic tale when I opened up the 2016 edition of Best American Sports Writing. The story is about Zilong Wang. It was written for Bicycling Magazine by John Brandt.
Zilong grew up in Shanghai. His first bike was a clunker, like most kids rode around in. But when he was 13 in middle school, he had the opportunity to buy this beautiful, shining hybrid giant bike.
A classmate of mine said he can sell me one at about half or one third of the price. And I know for sure that he's selling me a stolen bike, but I wanted the bike so much and I want to let him shoulder all the bad karma. So I wrote up a contract on a piece of paper, say if there is anything wrong any people come after me for the bike, he is responsible. I'm not responsible.
I didn't know that karma was responsive to contracts. I thought it was like something more mysterious than that.
That's right. Yeah, later I learned the hard way. After about a few months of riding that bike I knew was a stolen bike, it got stolen by somebody else again. So I guess that's how karma actually works.
Zelong looked for the bike, of course. He never found it.
Easy come, easy go. It's karma, so there's no way I can get the bike back.
The years rolled by, and Zelong, like lots of young men in China, decided that he would try to further his education by coming to the U.S. He chose Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, a non-traditional college without grades. A couple of Hampshire alumni had decided to learn about the U.S. by riding across the country by bicycle. They'd survived the adventure. Zelong liked the idea, and after graduation, he found a bike he wanted to ride. It was a surly long-haul trucker. It wasn't fancy, but it was right.
And it's a silver-white color, and as soon as I saw that bike, I knew the exact name for it. It's the White Dragon Horse.
I've been riding the same bicycle now for 5 years, and I have yet to name it, but what made you feel it had to have a name?
I didn't want to give it a name, but the journey called for a name. The White Dragon Horse is a mystical creature from the story Journey to the West, Xi Yu Ji. It described the Chinese monk who walked all the way from China to India to bring back the Buddha's teaching. And the horse that the monk rode was the White Dragon Horse. As soon as I saw the bike, I knew that the bike wanted a name.
Part of what attracted John Brandt to the story was the audacity of the journey. Another part of the attraction was Zelong's daily plan.
He decided every night he was going to knock on the door of a stranger, knock on the door and ask if he could pitch his tent in the backyard.
I had no confidence that it would work at all. So the first night I could not work up the courage, so I stayed in the empty Boy Scout camp. But there were so many mosquitoes, I got 30 bites, and when I tried to use a hose there to shower, a whole bunch of ants poured out because it wasn't used for so long. That first night out was just so miserable that I decided, okay, whatever, I'm going to knock on doors tomorrow. And from that day on, every single night that I knocked on the door, somebody said yes and invited me in.
So nobody ever said no, try some other neighbor?
Oh, most of people say no. One in five say yes.
Sometimes Zelong thought about turning back. The doubts passed, and the better moments arrived.
Those moments are when I connect with a stranger, when the next morning when I depart, we both have tears in our eyes. When I feel this connection with nature, feel this trust in the universe, those are just worth any of the pain, the discomforts.
Between Massachusetts and California, Zelong connected with lots of strangers. He remembers with special fondness some of the ones who most surprised him.
The Christian fundamentalists, the Republicans, at that time would be the Romney and now the Trump supporters. Essentially, for the majority of the trip in the middle of the country, I was staying every night with corn farmers, with people who are volunteering at the church. Those who I have thought are close-minded or xenophobic or all these labels, they were the most welcoming and warm and good-hearted people.
Would those people have been as welcoming, warm, and good-hearted to anyone asking for tent space and perhaps a cup of tea? Zelong wonders about that in a blog he wrote along the way.
Just imagine, if I were black, I would be a good target for some paranoid neighborhood watch. If I were Hispanic, people might wonder if I'm in the country legally. If I were Middle Eastern, I might look like a terrorist to some. If I were a white American, I wouldn't be as interesting as someone from China.
And he was on a bicycle. Maybe people figured what harm could be in him.
For all the magic of his crossing, for all the cosmic connections that were forged, there was little conventional drama. No fights. No violence, no steamy love scenes, just a young man pedaling a bicycle all day and talking quietly to people in the evening.
The people's home that I went into, they say, aren't you afraid? Have you met any bad people? for that entire 75 days, I have met exactly zero bad person, not even a harsh word or ill intention from anyone, only goodwill after goodwill. So it really gave me a lot of faith in not just the U.S., but also in humanity in general.
In general, his entire journey, I think, went like almost like a dream. Good luck with the weather, good luck with his bicycle. Everything seemed to work really well. His health was good. He didn't get injured, didn't get ill. Everything went pretty well until he reached the end.
When I was riding through the U.S., I didn't even bring a lock with me. I never locked my bike once. I leave it outside Walmart, at museums, outside little towns, and go away for half an hour, come back, the bike is still there. Nobody touched it. 3 weeks after arriving in San Francisco, the bike was stolen while locked as I went into a fruit stand to get some oranges just within 5 minutes.
Zelong called the police. He described the bike. One of the officers wrote down what he said. Zelong was not encouraged to think the White Dragon horse would turn up.
The loss is greater than the bike. If, as he's always believed, the stolen bicycle he'd bought back in Shanghai was taken from him as some sort of cosmic retribution, what does it mean that he's now also lost the White Dragon horse, the honestly acquired engine of his transformation and his great understanding and appreciation of so much of life, knowledge, and America? Is this really, he thinks, how the cosmic tale of the White Dragon horse was supposed to end? And if so, what to make of it? What is the lesson?
The lesson took about 48 hours to reveal itself, and then it was a beaut. It turned out that a young woman who worked for a company that made bicycle accessories and, hence, knew something about bikes, saw the man who stole the White Dragon horse with the steed. She thought, he doesn't look as if he belongs on it.
The guy was dressed raggedly. He was not a cyclist. He was running against traffic, and the bike was way too big for him. And this woman, Vanessa, decided, well, that's weird. That bike is probably stolen, but what am I going to do about it? Something you see every day in San Francisco. But for some reason, she couldn't let this go. She couldn't just let the guy ride away. So she started following him, got closer to him, and the guy pulled up into a doorway of an apartment building. And Vanessa said that normally she would never think about doing it like this. She never done it like it before, but something was telling her, well, I'm going to just talk to this man. Finally, she said, this isn't your bike, this is Paul's bike. The name Paul just jumped into her head, but that was enough to break the ice and the guy split. It was meant to be. The cosmos was telling her to get this bike back for this man.
Yeah, that's actually the core of the story, and I'm forever grateful for her, Vanessa was her name, for restoring my faith in humanity.
Who would ask for more than to have his or her faith in humanity restored? And then there's this question, who, having ridden across the United States, would ever want to get on a bicycle again?
So I worked in San Francisco for 2+ years and one day had this calling that I should go on a journey to the east and ride my bike back to China where I was from. So 9 months ago, I embarked on this journey to the east, a pilgrimage more or less around the world once by bicycle, in service of the ecological and spiritual awakening of our time.
And how's that trip going?
Very well. Well, in the sense that a pilgrimage gives you not what I think I want, but exactly what I need, including all the hardship and the turmoils inside and outside.
So, the lesson. Perhaps there is no end point to the quest for enlightenment. Maybe once one begins accumulating faith in humanity, mysteriously, the vessel never overflows. Zelong rides on. John Brandt's story from Bicycling is called Zelong Wang and the Cosmic Tale of the White Dragon Horse and the Karmic Moonbeams of Destiny that Restored All Faith in Humanity. It was one of 27 worthy entries in 2016's Best American Sports Writing. Zelong spent the beginning of this summer in the UK quoting Charles Dickens. He wrote on his blog, "Judging from the headlines, this past month was certainly among the worst of times for England. Multiple terrorist attacks, horrific high-rise fire, ugly election. There was no shortage of foolishness, incredulity, darkness, and despair." Zelong traveled by bicycle, visiting a Buddhist monastery in Glastonbury Tor, a hill topped with a 14th century church tower. He left the UK at the end of June, feeling that his time in the country had indeed been the best of times. He's now continuing his pilgrimage overland to Shanghai, as he says, in service of the ecological and spiritual awakening of our time. If you haven't seen the 1993 movie The Sandlot, you're missing out. It's set in the summer of 1962, when a boy named Scotty Smalls moves to Los Angeles with his mother and her new husband. I'm not going to give too much away, so I'll just say that Scotty Smalls joins a Sandlot baseball game, and he is befriended by a player named Benny Rodriguez. And hilarity ensues. Just keep all that in the back of your mind. It's going to come up again during this next story by Only a Game's Karen Given.
Rob Querry is in his second season as head baseball coach at Heritage High School in Palm Bay, Florida. And like a lot of high school baseball coaches, he was having trouble motivating his players.
I was like Charlie Brown's teacher. The things I was saying, it was, you know, wah, wah, wah.
It's not as if Heritage High had a long history of winning.
Well, the school opened in 2009. And when I got the job, I was the third head coach in 3 years, and they had never had a winning season. Our team goal at the beginning of the year was to win 14 games, which would guarantee us a winning season. And we lost the first two games of the season. They just weren't hearing me, and so I tried to come up with something to motivate them.
And the motivation Rob came up with was not your usual, I'll buy you pizza, or I'll shave my head.
The motivation was that if they did meet the team goal and win 14 games, that they could name the baby.
Here's Rob's wife, Julia.
He came up with this the day we had our first ultrasound, and that's so much fun. You get to see your little baby, and they give you pictures of the ultrasound. So they did that first, and then we went back out to the waiting room. And that's when he told me, if they win 14 games, I'm going to tell them they can name this baby. And I laughed at him. I never gave permission. I only laughed at him. And I said, you're joking. And we just left it at that. He had to leave for practice.
I had a little black and white picture of the ultrasound, so I took it to practice that night, and when they all come up and they take a knee and we address certain things, I said, guys, I said, I've got some news. I said, I'm pregnant. And I showed them the picture and they all laughed and, you know, they were hooting and hollering and they were excited. And then I said, and if you guys win 14 games, you get to name the kid. And then they went nuts. They started jumping up and down, running around and high-fiving each other and stuff. And so that really fired them up. But within 10 seconds of telling them, two or three of them started saying, Benny Smalls, Benny Smalls, it's got to be Benny Smalls. And the rest of them were like, yeah, yeah, Benny Smalls.
Where did Benny Smalls come from? Well, you'd know if you'd watched the 1993 movie, The Sandlot.
Hey, you want a s'more? S'more what? No, no, you want a s'more. I haven't had anything yet, so how can I have some more of nothing?
Shut up!
You're killing me, Smalls.
The Sandlot is a great baseball movie, and when we had our first team meeting this year, we went to the auditorium at school, and I handed out their hats, and we went over the program plan, and then we watched the movie The Sandlot on the big screen, so it's kind of ingrained in our program, so that's where Benny Smalls came from.
And the big question, Julia, are you as big a fan of The Sandlot as your husband and his baseball team?
Well, who doesn't love that movie? And who doesn't love that movie if they love baseball? Then they started winning games, and I started getting pretty nervous. It's exciting. It's so exciting when they win games. But with that on the line, it was a different story in my mind. Once I started showing, I started to rub my stomach and remind them of how many more games they had to win before they could name this cute little baby that was inside of my stomach. And then that number started getting smaller, and I stopped taunting them.
It definitely felt like she was warming up to the idea. And I would tell her, I'd say, hey, you can't taunt them like that if you're not going to follow through with it. It was kind of back and forth at the beginning. We would win one, lose one, win one, lose one. But then right before the spring break, We went on a 7-game winning streak.
The team was now at 13 wins on the season, just one win away from their goal.
We went into a game with a crosstown rival, and there was probably 200 people at the game, which is about 160 more than are normally at the games. And there was a lot of excitement around that game, and we didn't win that game. It was a huge letdown. It felt like we lost by 10,000 runs. We won the game the next night.
They said, "Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm in. I'll do it." Oh, they started cheering and jumping up and down. It was so much fun.
We started off the season, the players would get up in a group at the end of every practice and game, and they would say Panther Pride, but now they say Panther Family.
Which leaves me wondering, what happens next year?
I already told them I don't know what you're going to do next season because I'm not going to have another baby just so you can win.
Yeah, I'll have to pray on it.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Benjamin Small's Ellis Query was born 8 weeks early on July 27, 2016. He weighed just 3.5 pounds. Small's indeed, his mother Julia says. Despite arriving early, Benny has met all his milestones and he's doing just great. The Heritage High School baseball team is also doing well. They won their first playoff game in program history. Coach Rob says it was a huge upset. When his older son died, Dave McDougall decided to take his younger son on a baseball pilgrimage.
I picked him up on the last day of school, and we headed north, and it was an amazing trip.
Remembering Johnny, just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and hang on, don't hit that double fast-forward arrow for a second, because I want to tell you about another WBUR podcast I know you're going to love. After all, it's called Modern Love, and it's a collaboration between WBUR and the New York Times, featuring true stories of love, loss, and redemption performed by noteworthy actors.
In any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a day when you wonder why you married this person.
She's dead to me, I told my friends.
Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had, I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back.
It's easy to love the beautiful, the normal. But what about the gifts of loving the strange, the uncommon, the odd?
Modern Love, the podcast from WBUR and the New York Times. Subscribe right now on your favorite podcast app for a new episode every week.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Before the highway was built in the 1950s, Cape Cod was a sleepy sort of place, primarily occupied by fishermen and farmers. Over the decades, Cape Cod has become one of New England's favorite summer vacation destinations, visited by millions every year to enjoy sun, sand, and sandwich mini golf. Owned and operated by Morris Burke, better known as Mo, and his wife Sylvia. Only a Game's Gary Wallach is one of the mini golfers.
I've played sandwich mini golf almost every summer since I was 5 years old. It's a lovable little course, wedged between Route 6A and a salt marsh. A bubbling brook flows under the course's many bridges, around a simulated giant lily pad, and past a white whale and a tiny lighthouse. Earlier this summer, Mo, Sylvia, and I sat down inside a little barn filled with landscaping equipment and a Model A Ford that gleams like it's just been driven off the lot. Mo tells me that the land on which the course is built has been in Burke's family for about a century.
My grandfather had a kind of a little farm on the edge of the marsh, and it had a cranberry bog. In 1930, the state decided to put a superhighway through, and it split up the cranberry bog. So it was just a few cranberries left, enough cranberries to eat, but the swamp had no real value at the time.
As a kid, the only thing Mo spent money on was mini golf, so he came up with a plan. In 1950, at the age of 15, he began work on a course, single-handedly.
It was swamp reclamation, so it took a few years just to fill in the swamp. My dad had an old truck, so I could get 5 loads of sand in an hour if I shovel really fast. My first goal was to get 9 holes.
Cape Cod tourism grew steadily in the 1950s and 60s, so Mo had every reason to believe his course could be a moneymaker from the outset, even in sleepy traditional Sandwich, a town that has always maintained tight control on development. Mo knew his mini-golf would have to win the approval of tourists and town fathers, so he focused on the land's natural features.
I was just kind of working along the stream, and then another hole that came quickly after was Treasure Island, when I diverted the stream, and we had to dig all these tons of mud and dirt and sand out to make an island. A lot of people thought I was crazy. That'll never work. Luckily, when my wife married me, she didn't put her foot down and say, "What are you doing?"
Sylvia told me at the outset that she didn't want to be part of the interview, but when Mo started talking about their lives and their golf course, she couldn't help herself.
When I married this man, Morris Burke, it was a great blessing. He is a gentleman with a heart of love.
I look over at Mo. Sylvia's words have him fighting back tears.
I believed in him, even when the mini golf only had 9 holes. We had a sign 18 holes, and people would say, "Well, where are the other 9? I said, "Well, you play these twice." And that's the way we started.
We've been married for 59 years this summer. She's gone through the good times and the bad. When I opened, there weren't a lot of customers. If I took in $10, that was a lot because we only charged 50 cents. I just had faith that if I built it, someone would come.
They didn't come to the Burke's Putting Greens of Dreams, not right away. But Mo and Sylvia had another kind of faith. So while they waited for their business to take off, they took missionary jobs in South America.
From 64 to 68, we were in Ecuador teaching in Christian schools. When we came home, we continued. I'm sure there are times when we weren't sure how we were going to pay our next bill. We prayed over the golf course every step of the way because it's what you call a faith type thing for the next 10 years. I pretty much finished it. By the mid-70s, it was starting to take in some money. It took a few years before it really was a legitimate mini golf.
By this time, Cape Cod's tourism industry had exploded. There were more attractions everywhere, including bigger, glitzier mini golf courses. But Cape Cod is a summer destination, and the Burkes felt there was more missionary work to do overseas. They went to Taiwan for 12 years.
So we would just come home in the summer, but usually every summer I would add a hole. So by the end of our stay in Taiwan, which was 96, I think we had it well underway towards 36 holes.
After more than 3 decades, the Burkes retired from teaching. They remain in the mini golf business. As parts of Cape Cod have gone the way of mega malls, shopping outlets, and gated condo villages, their throwback mini golf has endured, quaintly and defiantly. Mo is now in his 80s. He and Sylvia could sell the course, pocket the $1 million, and just relax. But they won't sell. After 66 years of working on the course, Mo just doesn't seem to know how to stop.
And even in the winter, he's repainting. In the evening hours, he'll be busy carving signs. Every sign that's on the mini golf is all hand-carved by him.
Some of those brown and white signs depict little smiling whales that indicate hole number. Some contain rules, directions to the next hole, or snippets of psalms. There must be 200 of them. Mo says he plans to give the business to his son David, but for now there are customers on the course. He needs to get back to water flowers, reposition cobblestones, tidy the parking lot, and greet visitors. I love Sandwich Mini Golf because each time I play there, I feel like a kid. My wife and children seem to love it as much as I do. It's one of our very happy places. When we left the course after a recent visit, Morris Burke told me he looked forward to seeing us again at his mini-golf. Barring that, he said, someday we'd meet in heaven. I wonder, does Mo Burke see any difference between the two? For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
That story originally aired last summer. We checked back with Mo and Sylvia Burke, and they're happy to report that business at Sandwich Mini Golf is still going strong, and they still have no plans to sell. This summer, Mo and Sylvia are celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary. When he was a boy growing up outside Boston, Dave McDougall spent his summers going to Fenway Park with his dad and his siblings. He remembers those days fondly. So when he moved to Florida and started a family of his own, he looked forward to a lifetime of sharing his love of baseball with his two sons, Johnny, born in 2005, and Tommy, just 2 years younger. But life doesn't always go as planned. Here's Dave McDougall in his own words.
I love baseball. I've always gone to games, and I figure the best way, you know, to share something with my son is to start early. Johnny was born December 6, 2005. He was about 4 months old, and we went to opening day, and he never missed another one. He went to 9 opening days. Johnny was a great kid. He loved baseball, and, you know, he knew love. He felt love. He was generous. I always believed he would really change the world somehow. I don't know how. I never will. But I know that he would have. I was taking him when he was an infant, largely because I liked to go, and he just had no choice in the matter. But I think when he was 1.5, maybe 2 years old, you know, he would always, you know, say, well, we're going to the game, and he'd go and fetch his shirt and put it on and be ready to go. Going through Washington, after a day at the museums, we went to another museum, the ballpark. It was just me and Johnny. We had great seats, third base side, upper deck, first row, right on top of the action, right between the mound and the plate where I like to sit. And they were playing the Mets, and it was a beautiful night. It was after that that I said to him, and he was about 3. I said, the nation's filled with a variety of things, including different ballparks, so we should see them all. And he said, yeah, I'd love to. There was never any set plan. I figured we had years, decades to do this trip. It was something that we were definitely going to accomplish. It was just a question of when. He suffered a catastrophic brain aneurysm. It was about 9 p.m. He suffered tremendous brain damage, and his body just systematically shut down. And within 26 hours, he was dead. He was 9 years, 1 month old. You're, I guess, at first lost, but you push through it. You know, you just do the best you can. I guess it was maybe a few days after he passed, I wrote his eulogy, and somehow the theme of baseball just kind of poured out. So I touched on the fact that we went to baseball games. It was a great way for us to connect, that he never missed opening day. He never will, because no matter what, I'm always going to go to opening day. I'll buy him a ticket. That's just the way it has to be. Tommy is just an amazing kid. He has his own voice, and it's a very loud voice, and he lets you know what he's thinking every minute of the day. No, he didn't take to baseball nearly as quickly as Johnny did. He would say, do I have to go? Do I have to go? I'm like, yeah, you have to go. I would say, the only cotton candy available is at the ballpark. And he would say to that, let's go. Well, I told Tommy, I said, look, your brother passed away, you know. I said, we're going on an adventure trip. and we're going to spread his ashes at all the ballparks across the United States. And he was all for it. He said, sure, let's do it. Let's make this happen. Opening day in Miami is when it all began. It was a place that was familiar to Johnny. It was his ballpark. We got in there early, and we were given field access. We went up to third base and just did a little, and I'm talking a tic-tac amount of ashes being spread. So we said a little prayer, and for me, it was very special. In 2015, I looked at the schedule, you know, when Tommy would get out of school and who's playing home, where. I picked him up on the last day of school, and we headed north. And it was an amazing trip. We scatter his ashes during the seventh inning stretch, and it's a happy time. We remember Johnny. We say really nice things about Johnny, and, you know, it's a way that I think that Tommy's healing too. I know that I want to accomplish it in the next 2 or 3 years so that Tommy can truly benefit from a trip like this, an amazing journey that he gets to enjoy. We drive and we camp, you know, roast marshmallows and cook hot dogs and that sort of fun stuff. It's joy, pure joy. He's come to love going to baseball games now. You know, what started out Tommy being a little kid who, I don't want to go to, I now call him the cotton candy kid, able to tell what his favorite ballpark is, or, you know, who has the best cotton candy in the land. I bought nosebleed tickets at Arlington, where the Texas Rangers play ball, you know, way up in the upper deck, and my phone battery died, and I was down charging my telephone, and this big guy from Texas came over, and I was wearing my Miami Marlins shirt, and he said, hey, we should trade shirts. And I was like, well, this shirt won't fit you. He's a big dude. We just started chatting while charging our phones. He said, what are you doing here? And I told him, and he said, where are you sitting? he said, where are you sitting? And I told him, and he said, no, it's not good. You can have my seats. You know, you tell a story, and it just connects with people, and people are generous. They are, and they were great seats, and he was just a nice guy. And an inning later, I turned around, he's sitting behind me, and he says, I know everybody here. They know me, so it's fine. I honor my son now by fulfilling the promise I made to him that we would do it. You know, in his honor, perhaps, but more so just getting up early and just doing it. You know, you can't shut down. You have to move forward. And I think he'd be really, really pleased with that. You know, when I accomplish this goal with Tommy, you know, we'll have, you know, something more to look forward to. You know, you bypass amazing sights that you don't have time to stop. You have to get to the next ball game. You know, national parks in the, you know, out west. You go back to California and surf. Do something fun.
Since we spoke last fall, Dave McDougall and his son Tommy have continued their summer vacation baseball adventures. As soon as school got out in June, Dave and Tommy hit the road, traveling more than 4,000 miles over 30 days. They remembered Johnny at 9 ballparks and even managed a bonus trip to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Dave hopes to get to Seattle later this season, leaving just 5 ballparks for summer vacation 2018. You can follow along with Dave and Tommy's next adventure. We'll have a link to their website at onlyagame.org. Our story was produced by Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. And our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return from summer vacation next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks very much for listening.